You're listening to Radio MD. She's a chiropractic holistic physician, best-selling author, international speaker, entrepreneur, and talk show host. She's Dr. Suzanne Bennett. It's time now for Wellness for Life Radio. Here's Dr. Suzanne.
If you've ever seen any of the movies with the late James Coburn, you would have quickly noticed that he had a crippling arthritic condition in his hands. He had what's called rheumatoid arthritis, RA for short, and it's the most common type of autoimmune arthritis and is triggered by an immune dysregulation that can affect more than just your joints and your hands. And that could include the skin, the eyes, lungs, heart, and blood vessels. Now today on Wellness for Life Radio, we have rheumatoid arthritis expert, Dr. Ara Dukranian, who is in private practice at the Cabrillo Center for Rheumatoid Disease. Now, he's here to share his insights on rheumatoid arthritis and its effects on personal relationships. Great to have you here with us, Dr. D.
It's a pleasure to be here, Dr. Bennett. Thank you.
Absolutely. Now, can you tell us first, what is RA? What is rheumatoid arthritis?
Certainly. So, as you alluded to, rheumatoid arthritis is an autoimmune condition. And I think for most people who talk about arthritis in general, what they're referring to is the more common osteoarthritis, which is a degenerative wear and tear type of arthritis that we all get as we get older. As contrasted to that, rheumatoid arthritis is more of a systemic disease, an autoimmune disease, which means the immune system, for some reason, is turned on and attacking healthy tissues in the body. And that's manifest as inflammation, such as stiffness and swelling and pain in many joints in the body. So the two main types of arthritis, osteoarthritis and rheumatoid arthritis, obviously have different causes and therefore are treated differently. And as you suggested in your introduction, rheumatoid arthritis being a systemic disease, it can have manifestations outside of the joints as well.
Right. You know, on your website, I took a look at it, arthritis.com. There is specifically the two different informations, which looks really nice and will help a lot of people out there who are not sure what they might have. Maybe they're just starting to feel joint pain and all that. How many people do you think suffers from rheumatoid arthritis in this country?
Yeah, the estimates of rheumatoid arthritis in the United States are somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million people. So between 0.5 and 1% of the general population has rheumatoid arthritis. And you're right in that many people do attribute sort of fatigue and joint aches and sometimes joint pain as being part of normal daily life, as stress or being overworked or maybe sleeping on the wrong type of mattress. But obviously a lot of these things which don't go away with time and maybe are progressing and taking a heavier toll on people's lives should really come to attention. So patients and people in general can educate themselves on different types of arthritis on websites such as arthritis.com. And certainly we would encourage them to go seek some professional help with their doctors to help distinguish between the different types of arthritis they may have.
Well, let's talk about the way a doctor might distinguish between the two. What are the specific tests that they might do? Of course, you can do x-rays to see the disruptions in the joints, but how about specific tests that indicate that a person has RA?
Yeah, you're absolutely right in that there are some tests that we use to supplement our clinical impression. And generally, the diagnosis of arthritis really is a clinical one, and sometimes we're aided by things like x-rays or MRIs or ultrasounds and specific lab tests. So the way that a rheumatologist or any doctor who's keen on diagnosing rheumatoid arthritis would approach it is really looking for symmetry in the inflammation in the joints, because classically, rheumatoid arthritis affects the same joints on the right side and the left side of the body. It may not do that initially in the early stages, but certainly progresses to involve the small joints of the hand, the wrist, and really any joint from the shoulders on down to the ankle and toes. So that's one way. And then we look for various lab tests, which can give us a little more information. Typically, there are markers for rheumatoid arthritis called rheumatoid factor, and various other autoantibodies, such as EP antibodies. There are markers of inflammation that we look for in the blood. And then ultimately, some type of imaging if the diagnosis is still uncertain, or even just to give some prognosis to patients. We know, obviously, that x-rays in the very early stages of arthritis can look normal. So if there's a question, we use advanced imaging techniques such as ultrasounds and MRIs to give us a better picture of the joint if the answer isn't quite certain yet.
Dr. D, you know, I'm a big believer looking through for the root cause of disease, root cause of symptomatology. And I've done a lot of studies and I see a lot of patients who've got different various autoimmune conditions. And one of the things that I've been, really looking and diving into, especially in the scientific literature, is on molecular mimicry as the pathogenesis. I don't know if you're open to talk about it, but I'd love to hear what your take is on that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right in that ultimately we still don't understand with a great degree of certainty the true cause of rheumatoid arthritis. What we do understand is that people are born with a genetic predisposition to developing it, and then some type of insult, some type of environmental insult that sort of triggers arthritis to start. And really, in the very early stages of the onset of rheumatoid arthritis, it may remain silent until it sort of manifests as inflammation at the joints and fatigue and a lot of these other systemic complaints. That process may take from weeks to months to even years in some cases. So those triggers, people have had a lot of interest over the past few decades to see what is it about these genetically predisposed people that sort of tips them over the edge. And people have looked at various types of infections with viruses and bacteria and certain fungal infections. A lot of the evidence for that has sort of fallen by the wayside. It's not being convincing enough. There has been quite a bit of literature over the last decade looking at gingivitis and specific gum infections that may be more predisposed in smokers. And we know that smokers have an increased prevalence of rheumatoid arthritis. So that may tie in between the gum disease and smoking and the onset of rheumatoid arthritis. Other people have looked towards the gut and the normal bacterial flora that may sort of overgrow in certain situations and cause this molecular mimicry. And really, molecular mimicry just comes down to the immune system recognizing the healthy certain molecular signals on normal tissue as being indicative of an infection. So mimicking, for example, a bacterial or a viral infection, and thereby that might initiate that immune response that turns autoimmune in nature because it is directed against normal healthy tissue. So I think at this point it's
that.
A wonderful concept. Of course, of course. Still
yes.
A lot more research needs to be done, but I think focusing on this area of molecular mimicry and seeing the bacteria that we harbor and live with typically may sometimes turn against us.
Right, right. And in my practice, I go into a great deal of working with intestinal permeability issues that I believe is one of the triggers of autoimmune conditions. It doesn't have to be RA, but many different kinds of autoimmunity. And it's all coming out now. And by having a healthy gut and a gut flora that is not an overgrowth and infectious is probably one of the best steps to start prevention. And you know, one of the things that I'm also interested in to ask you is, what are the first questions that a person who might be diagnosed, who may be diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, what are the first questions that they usually ask you?
Yeah, the first question typically has to do with sort of accepting the diagnosis. So for a lot of patients who've had symptoms perhaps for weeks or months, that search for an answer as to what is the cause that I'm not feeling quite right, and finally coming down with the diagnosis is sometimes a bit of a relief to put a name to the symptoms that they've had. And then really it's the expected typical questions of, well, what can I expect? What is the natural progression of arthritis? And what can I do, obviously, to manage it? A lot of people in the early stages are interested in a cure. You know, can this go away? A very other common question as relates to the age group of that rheumatoid arthritis affects younger women who may have children that they're concerned about passing on this disease to. That comes up very often as well. But we find that as people sort of progress over their initial management to treatment plan, setting goals is very important. And that's something that sometimes isn't discussed with as much detail as we wish. So a goal for managing rheumatoid arthritis for one patient may be very different than for someone else based on demographics, based on situation in life, based on occupation. And unless we sort of talk about what are the goals for managing rheumatoid arthritis and specifically try to target those goals from visit to visit, we may be falling short over managing the person as a whole, as opposed to just their rheumatoid arthritis. But the problem that we come to with trying to address questions is that obviously anyone diagnosed with any chronic condition is going to have questions seeking answers. And traditionally, those answers are sought through a doctor's office or a visit, which typically obviously doesn't last long enough to address even a small percentage of a patient's concerns or questions. So we're always looking for areas where we can supplement some of that counseling and education outside of the typical exam room, even outside of the office visit. And utilizing websites and podcasts and printed material where some of this information might be digested in a more timely fashion.
Yes, and of course that information can be found at arthritis.com. And, you know, I had a guest come on a while back, and it was about pain and how pain can really affect our relationships. Because when someone's in pain, whatever type of pain it is, whether it's a headache or stomach ache or arthritic condition, you don't, if you've got an intimate, you know, someone who is a partner of yours, you have trouble often even being touched by that person, right? So do you actually, you know, advise on individuals who've got partners and relationships on how to deal with this possible chronic condition?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very important part of the overall management of patients is involving family, the significant other or partner, and even close friends to really help understand what the person with rheumatoid arthritis or any type of chronic pain condition is really going to. Because pain is sometimes visible, but you know, there may not be very objective measures of it. So if a typical patient with, let's say, rheumatoid arthritis is so tired because of the disease and in pain and really just wants to relax and not be able to do the expected daily chores that he or she needs to do, then that might set up some unreasonable expectations about what is expected from that patient from other family members and close friends. So it doesn't sometimes leave room for intimacy if a patient's primary concern is managing the pain, relaxing. So there are a lot of feelings of inadequacy that come up and misunderstandings, such as unreasonable expectations of what a person may or may not be able to do. And unless there's an open and honest dialogue between those involved, the patient and immediate family members or partners, then I think there's going to be some misunderstanding down the line. So it's critically important that especially when patients are newly diagnosed, I always encourage them to bring their spouse or significant other to come and help understand a little bit about what rheumatoid arthritis is all about and how it can involve more than just the joint. We always assume, and we've had a lot of breakthroughs in therapy, that turning off the inflammation from this autoimmune condition by utilizing the drugs that we use will necessarily sort of positively impact a patient in all ways. Yet we find that even in patients who have well-controlled arthritis, they still have other causes for pain. It may come from depression. It may come from fibromyalgia. It may come from other pain generators that the patient may have. Or a well-controlled arthritic patient may still not be able to fully work or do the hobbies that he or she used to enjoy. And so trying to understand why that might be by the support system that the patient has is critically important in their overall well-being.
In your practice, do you see just mainly arthritis, or do you see all forms of autoimmune conditions? Do you see all types, or is it mainly arthritic conditions?
Yeah, so I think most rheumatologists would have a large percentage of their patients as being arthritic. Though I think, like many of my colleagues, I see a whole variety of autoimmune from things like lupus and Sjogren's disease to things like fibromyalgia and osteoporosis and rarer conditions like vasculitis. And what all of these conditions have in common is that they take a toll on a patient's capacity to live a normal life, however a patient may define that. And that might be because of pain. It might be because of comorbidities such as depression and anxiety and lack of sleep and fatigue. But the immune system being involved and generating pain on a nearly chronic basis is really common to all of these conditions. And so what we talk about with rheumatoid arthritis here can sometimes be applied to these other areas as well.
I wrote the book, The 7-Day Allergy Makeover, Dr. D, and it was part of it because of my son, who is so severely allergic, who pretty much everything, food and environmental insults, but also he had anaphylaxis, anaphylactic reaction. So what I found was through many, many years of training and all that in more environmental medicine as well as allergies, that a lot had to do with his environment and the food that he was eating and, of course, ultimately his gut. Do you recommend changes in food and dietary guidelines for someone who has RA?
Yeah, we talk about it, and if I don't bring it up, patients sometimes bring up what things can I do that are natural and non-medicinal that can help with my arthritis. And unfortunately, we don't have guidelines that are based on traditional evidence-based medicine or trials that look at various supplements or dietary changes. So what I encourage people to do, and what sometimes patients do on their own, is identify triggers such that they eat certain foods may, in their case, trigger an inflammatory response and they sort of feel worse that day or the next day. And we find that often those triggers have to do with dairy products or processed carbohydrates. So these tend to come up a little bit more frequently than other effects. So what I encourage patients to do is to try various changes by promoting an anti-inflammatory diet high in fiber, green leafy vegetables, whole grain foods, to really utilize nature's resources to help this anti-inflammation that patients are trying to achieve, and then seeing what works and what doesn't work for patients. So I don't have, I and many of my colleagues don't have an algorithm as to what foods should be avoided and what foods should be supplemented, but it is taken on an individual basis. And certainly we try to utilize literature as well as nutritionists to try and get patients to eat a well-balanced diet. We know one example of that really is that obesity obviously has a lot of health risks and risk factors and such, but obesity as it relates to rheumatoid arthritis and can actually promote inflammation. So it really goes against what we're trying to achieve with our medicines if a patient's not also trying to lose some of the excess weight that he or she may have.
That's great to hear. And of course, I totally understand about the obesity, fat number one being an inflammatory organ. Do you know much about, how do you recommend exercise? I mean, if you have people that are feeling extremely amounts of pain and have difficulty moving, what type of exercise do you recommend?
Yeah, so I think one of the frustrations that patients feel, especially if they've had an exercise regimen prior to their arthritis onset, is the expectation that they'd like to get back to that normal exercise routine. And although that's possible, that may not necessarily happen in the early stages when the arthritis is still not well controlled because the therapy hasn't yet had an effect. So I think pacing oneself to a new normal and using a combination of very low weight training as well as aerobic exercise. I think any of us would agree that any arthritic patient is best served by some type of aerobic activity, whether that's weight bearing or non-weight bearing, just depending on the joints and the tolerance of that patient. But what that does is it promotes anti-inflammation by just the exercise alone, as well as releasing the endorphins that are much needed in terms of our feel-good hormone that comes on with aerobic activity. And if there are specific strengthening exercises that support the structures around the joint, so if someone has, for example, bad knees from arthritis, it's critically important that their quadriceps muscles be strengthened. So obviously those have specific exercises. So we always utilize, whenever possible, the expertise of physical and occupational therapists. And if patients have the luxury of a personal trainer, to at least get them to a well-balanced exercise program, those are always very, very useful.
Mm. I'm glad that we've talked to you about a lot of the natural ways to help and maybe even mitigate the condition. But I would like to go into just a little bit about the type of medications, because it is often you just have to take them, because it's the only way that you'll be able to stop the inflammatory reaction and autoimmune issues. So can we just briefly go over some of the treatment protocols that you also recommend? I'm talking about medications that might be needed for a rheumatoid arthritic patient.
Yeah, certainly. So given that rheumatoid arthritis is an autoimmune condition, the primary defect in the disease has to do with the immune system, then most of our medications are geared to reduce inflammation and also dampen that hyperimmune response. So anti-inflammatory medications like simple non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs such as ibuprofen and naproxen, for example, corticosteroids, or what most people consider cortisone or prednisone, have very powerful anti-inflammatory effects. And are very useful, typically in the short term, just to prevent a lot of the side effects that may happen with long-term use, is another category. Then a lot of our other medications are either immune modulating or immune suppressing, just depending on how much immune suppression is needed. So we have traditional, what we call DMARDs, disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs, the best-known example of which is methotrexate. And there are a whole host of others. And then there's a whole host of another category of drugs called biologics, which target specific pro-inflammatory proteins or cytokines that patients with rheumatoid arthritis have. And a lot of the advances in managing rheumatoid arthritis, certainly over the last 15 years or so, really have to do with the advent of these targeted therapies, so specific medications that target specific parts of the immune system, and that's what we call biologic medication. So depending on each person's rheumatoid arthritis and severity and prognosis, a management plan that includes these medications is tailored for their purposes, with always the goal of getting the patient into either remission or as close to remission as possible.
You know, often I get patients that have been taking some of these drugs and they come to see me after because they want to get off of them and they want to be able to live a longer life without taking these drugs. So these drugs can also create a great deal of side effects and cause other damaging issues. So I'd like to know in your clinical experience, can people get off of them once they start?
Yeah, it's a great question, Dr. Of course, yeah. And I think what we've seen is because some of these therapies are so effective and really have put people into long periods of remission, there's been a lot of curiosity both in the United States and certainly in Europe on trying to approach patients with a very aggressive treatment course very early in their management. So as soon as they're diagnosed, really to treat them to very aggressively to get them to remission, and then trying to back away from treatment after a while. And there have been many instances where that aggressive early approach is taken that patients have been able to maintain a drug-free remission after a period of time. We still don't know what predicts that. It seems that the more aggressive and the deeper the state of remission and how quickly that's achieved seem to be the best predictors as to who might be able to get a drug-free remission. So if patients have symptoms and certain therapies are tried that are maybe partially effective and not effective, then really the chance, that window of opportunity for true remission and getting patients off drugs becomes less and less as time goes on. So we do have that window of opportunity, which is really why it's critically important that anyone with rheumatoid arthritis, as quickly as they can, get in with the rheumatologist and have that discussion about the efficacy and the side effect balance profile of medication, and try to get them to as close to that remission with the eventual goal, at least in a good minority of patients, at least to maintain a drug-free remission off therapy.
I think from the patients that I've seen who've just been diagnosed with RA, I've found that the best results are combining the work that Holistic Doctors Lives, myself, do, working on the lifestyle, working on their diet, working on their nutritional deficiencies and repletion, and that in combination with possibility of the drugs for short term are really the best results. At least that's what I see in my practice, and I'm really glad that we had you here.
Agree.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
great information.
You.
Dr. D.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
It's been a pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity, Dr. Ben.
Oh, thank you. Okay, arthritis.com is where you're going to find a lot more information about rheumatoid arthritis as well as osteoarthritis. I've put a link on my Wellness for Life radio show page on Radio MD. And this is Dr. Suzanne sharing natural strategies for ultimate health and wellness right here on Radio MD. Until next time, stay well.